Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
It's been a little while since we've heard that intro, but here we are again looking at the possibility of another Alex Murdaugh trial. Today, a hearing took place. This was a status hearing addressing what will be discussed in the upcoming Alex Murdaugh evidentiary hearing, which will then decide whether or not Alex Murdaugh gets a new trial. We have two segments for you today, arguments being made by familiar characters from the past, including Creighton Waters, Jim Griffin, and Dick Harpudelin. Let's go to the courtroom for part one.
This is a pre-hearing procedure in the matter of state against Richard Alexander Murdaugh. It's case numbers 2022-GS-15-00592 through 00595. Defendant Murdaugh was indicted for the murder of his wife, Margaret Brandstetter Murdaugh, and his son, Paul Bennett Murdaugh, and related weapons charges. His trial began on January the 23rd, 2023. The presiding judge was Clifton Newman. After 6 weeks of trial, on the evening of March the 2nd, 2023, the jury returned a verdict of guilty on all four indictments, on which the defendant was sentenced on March 2023 to two consecutive terms of life imprisonment. Notice of appeals of his convictions and sentences were filed by defendant Murdaugh's attorneys on March the 9th, 2023 with the South Carolina Court of Appeals. The transcript in this very lengthy trial took several months to produce, even in draft form. Before the attorneys received the final transcript, on September the 5th, 2023, defendant filed with the Court of Appeals a motion to suspend his appeal and for leave to file a motion for a new trial with accompanying affidavits and transcript excerpts. After further defense and state filings, on October the 17th, 2023, the Court of Appeals granted appellant Murdaugh's motion to suspend the appeal and to remand this case to the circuit court to allow defendant Murdaugh to file a motion for a new trial. On October the 17th, 2023, defendant Murdaugh received the final trial transcript and very shortly thereafter filed a motion for new trial in the Colleton County Clerk of Court's office. Subsequently, Judge Clifton Newman recused himself from further proceedings in this matter. On December the 16th, 2023, on December the 18th, 2023, Chief Justice Donald W. Beatty signed an order appointing or directing that the Honorable Gene Hafer Toll, retired Chief Justice of South Carolina, be assigned exclusive jurisdiction for the limited purpose of presiding over defendant's motion for a new trial. I promptly contacted counsel in this case and set deadlines for briefing and arguments of the new trial motions. The new trial motions were set to be argued on January the 23rd, 30th, and 31st of 2024. And after several rounds of pretrial briefs having been submitted to me, I also set today's date for a procedural pre-hearing. Before I begin, may I say that we certainly welcome members of the media, and I thank publicly Attorney Jay Bender for agreeing to be the voluntary media coordinator for this matter, as he did for Judge Clifton Newman on the trial of this matter. Cell phones are normally not permitted at all in our courtrooms, but the press has been allowed to bring in certain cell phones and laptops and electronic devices because of the non-jury nature of this portion of the proceedings. But if any device rings or sounds to receive a call or to receive an email or a message, that device will be confiscated and the owner will be asked to leave the courtroom. So please now, if you haven't already, check your electronic devices and be sure that they will not sound during the time these proceedings take place. Major topics to be covered today have been addressed by me and discussed with counsel in a short pretrial conference in my chambers. And counsel may have certain things that they will put upon the record as we proceed through these topics that deal with what should be covered. The first topic is an evidentiary hearing necessary at all? The state took the position that the answer to that was no. Obviously, the defendant not. I have set an evidentiary hearing because I felt like we had to have some brackets on the time we would spend on this matter. But I've made no conclusive decisions beyond that on matters affecting the arguments the state makes about the procedural posture of this matter. The next topic would be the burden of proof. Who has the burden of proof in this matter? And what must be shown to meet that burden of proof? And what must then be shown to contest what has been shown and proved? The third topic is procedural defects, most specifically a contention by the state that this motion is untimely because what was known before a verdict was rendered, accepted in the jury poll. And finally, we need to discuss witnesses, juror witnesses, the clerk of the court of Compton County has appealed, and other witnesses and exhibits. I note that at least one attorney in the room is an attorney for some of the jurors, and other jurors may have other attorneys. When I get to the portion of this discussion where we talk about specific witnesses, and if I am asked to hear from attorneys for the witnesses, I will at least consider that request. I don't know where we will be at that time in terms of what has been decided, but I will at least inquire about that. To that end, if you have not already, during the first break, be certain that all of you, the lawyers participating at counsel table, and any other lawyers that feel they may have some interest in the proceedings that would warrant comment by them, please give your cards or information about your contacts to our court reporter, Ms. Harris. With that, Mr. Harper, being you are the moving party, you may proceed.
If it pleases the court, Your Honor, you've raised, I assume you want to go in the order in which you just...
I would.
Okay. You've raised a number of legal issues from whether we've waived, I forget the order in which you just took them, but Mr. Griffin is going to address those in seriatim based on what you said just a moment ago. As to the witnesses and the jurors, I will be handling that portion of the argument today.
Very good. Mr. Griffin, we'll hear from you now.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. The first issue that you've asked us to address is
is an evidentiary hearing necessary? And the answer to that question is very straightforward, is yes, under established case law in the Supreme Court, the Fourth Circuit, and the South Carolina Supreme Court under Reamer. A Reamer hearing is absolutely necessary where there has been credible evidence presented that there's been improper third-party contact with the jury prior to their deliberations that frankly, whether it goes to the merits or not, a Reamer hearing is absolutely necessary. And we believe that the Court of Appeals decision in this case contemplated a Reamer hearing. And in a Reamer hearing, evidence is presented as to what outside influences, if any, were brought to bear upon the jury. We have, in our motion for a new trial, submitted affidavits of one deliberating juror, one alternate, another affidavit of a witness to an interview of an alternate, where in all three statements are consistent, and in that they heard Ms. Hill, the clerk of court, prior to deliberations, and frankly before the defense put on their case, Ms. Hill instructed, do not be fooled by the defense. That's what the sworn statements say. And secondly, before Mr. Murdoch took the stand, Ms. Hill advised one deliberating juror and two alternates, at least, watch his demeanor, which is an implication of, he's going to lie. And so then the question becomes, factually, did those contacts happen? And then we proceed from there as to what the burden of proof is after that. But the threshold, are we entitled to evidentiary hearing? The law is crystal clear that we are.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Waters, to the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Your Honor, obviously, you've addressed the issue of whether an evidentiary hearing is necessary. The state certainly understands that. It is incumbent upon us, though, based on the law, to preserve our arguments as to procedural bar, and those are twofold. And the first one, of course, is that a motion for a new trial must be filed within 10 days of the verdict unless there's after-discovered evidence. And I think an initial inquiry that needs to be determined is when the defense first learned of these particular allegations. In conversations with the defense, and they said they're going to give me an answer, that they may have had conversations with Juror 785 prior to her being represented, which was only a couple days after trial. So if that is the case and they were aware of these allegations, then we would want to argue to Your Honor and preserve the issue that this is not after discovered evidence and that there's a procedural bar in that regard. Secondly, we made the argument that the affidavits on their face, the only deliberating juror indicated, and that's 630, in that affidavit only said that she voted guilty. She had questions but voted guilty because she felt pressured by other jurors. And of course, the law is crystal clear in multiple cases that sort of internal debate, it's actually in Rule 606B, that's not any sort of misconduct or anything that is a appropriate venue or mechanism in order to attack the verdict. So for that reason, we've argued that their showing in their motion for a new trial is insufficient based on the case law for an evidentiary hearing because there is, on its face, no sufficient allegation of prejudice. That being said, of course, we fully understand and expect the evidentiary hearing will go forward and we'll be happy to address burden of proof after the defense makes their arguments.
Very good. All right. With respect to, Mr. Griffin, anything in reply?
Your Honor, it does not appear that the state, takes a position contrary that a Reamer hearing is required. They're arguing that we have sort of waived the right to that hearing. There's no evidence of the record of that. I can assure the court we did not know of this information within 10 days after the trial. And when we learned of it, we promptly acted.
Well, in conversations with Mr. Harpootley and Mr. Griffin, they were going to actually look into that and look at their paralegal's notes. So I fully rely on and trust the defense to give me a fair answer to that question. And then again, if there's an issue to be raised, we would raise that. We're not conceding anything. We just wanted to preserve our procedural issues.
I, I don't think we need to go back and forth many times about this. I think I understand your position. But here is my position on the matter. First of all, this is not, I am not conducting a Rimmer hearing. Rimmer is a 1954 decision of the United States Supreme Court that deals with the question of influence of the jury and a motion for a new trial on the basis of after-discovered evidence of that influence. I rely on the South Carolina decision of our Supreme Court authored by Justice Kittredge, State versus Green. And the Green decision specifically says that Rimmer is not the guidance that South Carolina trial judges should look to in conducting hearings on after-discovered evidence. Now, that says nothing about what the burden of proof should be, and I don't intend to say anything thereby. But I do intend to tell you right away that I will be relying on South Carolina's jurisprudence and South Carolina's jurisprudence specifically on what must be proved in a hearing of this nature and who bears the burden of that proof. All right. And that leads to the very next topic that we'll now take up, which is the burden of proof. Mr. Griffin?
Yes, Your Honor. As we cited in our papers, we believe that the controlling case in this instance, based on the scope of conduct as alleged, and that is conduct of a court official here in clerk of court, having communication with the jury about the substance or the merits of the case, that the standard to be applied is not Green, because Green, Judge Kittredge says that the contact by the bailiff was about a procedural issue, not about the merits of the case. Here we're dealing specifically with the merits of the case, and the Court of Appeals decision in State v. Cameron, we believe, is the controlling standard. And in State v. Cameron, and that was decided in 1993, and the court says, in citing Holmes v. United States, which is a Fourth Circuit opinion, says in this case there was a private communication of the court official to members of the jury, an occurrence which cannot be tolerated if the sanctity of the jury system is to be maintained. When there has been such a communication, a new trial must be granted unless it clearly appears that the subject matter of the communication was harmless and could not have affected the verdict. Now, we strongly believe that is the standard. Is the question of, was the subject matter of the communication harmless and that it could not have affected the verdict? And we are, that's our position on the standard. Your Honor, if Your Honor looks to a different standard, we believe that State v. Green, the measure of State v. Green, you can't look just at Justice Kittredge's opinion. You have to look, because he complimented the Court of Appeals decision. And the Court of Appeals decision absolutely applied the Rimmer standard of the burden of production is on the defendant, but when the defendant produces evidence of a substantive communication to the jury by any third party, that's what Rimmer is, by any third party, that then there's a presumption of bias, and that the state then has to overcome that presumption, produce strong, clear, and convincing evidence that it was harmless. And that was the standard that the Court of Appeals applied in State v. Green. And in State v. Green, the Court of Appeals says that this is the standard of the Fourth Circuit, and we follow the Fourth Circuit law in this area. Now, Justice Kittredge says that the communication by the bailiff, which essentially said, if you're deadlocked, which they never were and never became deadlocked, then the judge may ask you to stay locked. I mean, that was the communication by the bailiff in Green, and Justice Kittredge said that did not go to the merits of the case. Justice Kittredge didn't throw out the Rimmer presumption standard. in State v. Green, Your Honor. And it's important, the Court of Appeals decision, looking to the Fourth Circuit, because, as Your Honor knows, this case, and I would encourage the Court to look at the Holmes decision out of the Fourth Circuit, which we cite, which applies Reamer. It applied Reamer in a habeas corpus case when they said Reamer is the clearly established law in the Fourth Circuit. And it vacated a death penalty conviction out of North Carolina because the North Carolina courts did not follow Reamer. And so the Court of Appeals decision in Green says we look to Reamer. Justice Kittredge says, we're not going to apply the Reamer presumption here because it didn't go to the merits. What we have in this case, and what we have, presented through proffer on the affidavits, something that goes to the heart of the merits. It's the defense, and it's the credibility of the defendant's testimony. And so we do have the burden of production, but we do believe that the standard in Cameron is we just have to show that the subject matter of the communication, that it was material to the case, and that then the burden shifts to the defendant to prove that it was harmless. Excuse me, the burden shifts to the state to prove it was harmless.
Thank you, sir.
That's what we believe the standard is.
Mr. Waters?
Sorry, Carl.
Your Honor, and I'm going to walk through some of the cases in South Carolina that address this issue. But as Your Honor is aware, of course, when we deal with these issues, we have two types. We have internal misconduct, and our courts have been reluctant. Rule 606 says this as well, to delve into that unless there are concerns of fundamental fairness, like racism and things like that. And then there's external allegations of external influence and that sort of thing. And that's what we're dealing with here today. And to quote State v. Grovenstein, which is a 1999 case of the state Supreme Court, it cites Aldrin and Kelly and says, we have consistently held the defendant must prove prejudice in these sorts of claims. And if we walk through all of the case law, our court has been very careful and as much said so in Aldrin, which was an internal case, to sync the analysis and the standards between those two and consistently held that the defendant has to show prejudice. It's their burden to do so. In Blake, in 1992, the court held, don't presume prejudice. And the test, of course, was whether or not the verdict was solely the product of honest deliberation or whether it was the product of outside influence. We go over to State v. Kelly. Your Honor concurred with Chief Justice Finney's dissent in that case. But in that case, there was a pamphlet in the grand jury room. Clearly, an external influence was alleged there. And ultimately, in that case, the court held that the defendant failed to show prejudice from that particular external influence. In State v. Grovenstein, in this instance, it was clearly external. There was an alternate who was present in the jury room and even took a preliminary vote with the jurors. So clearly an external influence, far more than is even alleged in this case. That juror was removed, curative instruction was given, but ultimately the court was very clear that we have consistently held the defendant must prove prejudice, again, the burden being on the defendant. In Bryant, this was a capital case, one that I argued way back when. And in that instance, there was a police investigation, background investigation into death qualified jurors in a capital case. Clearly external. The trial court conducted an inquiry with questions submitted by the parties as well, and ultimately noted that it was the defendant's burden to prove actual bias on the part of the jury. In State versus Pittman, another case that I argued before Your Honor, in that particular case, there was a juror who had a conversation with his wife and with the bartender. And ultimately, the court held that the defendant failed to meet the burden of prejudice because the wife's comment was the defendant was not guilty, and the comment to the bartender took place after deliberations had begun. And then, of course, in Green in 2020, Your Honor just commented on that, and the court clearly held that the Reamer presumption of prejudice doesn't apply here. And then, of course, went on to note that the defendant bears the burden of proving prejudice. And Cameron is a case that they rely on a lot. And I would say this about Cameron, that Cameron, of course, goes on to say that the mere fact of any official communication does not necessarily mean that the jury was prejudiced, and went on again to do a prejudice analysis and a harmless error analysis. Covington is a Court of Appeals case from 2000. In this particular case, there were jurors who supposedly knew the defendant and knew some external information about whether or not he had had previous difficulties with his wife and that sort of thing. Clearly external information. And again, the court held that the defendant failed to show prejudice. So the case law in South Carolina, both from our state Supreme Court as well as our state court of appeals, it's clear, it's in sync, it's uniform, that it's the defendant's burden to show prejudice. And that's, of course, only after there's a determination that any sort of extraneous influence occurred. And that would be the state's position, that it is the defendant's burden. And again, we can address at the appropriate time what the state's position is as to the order of which the evidentiary hearing should go.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Griffin, can you reply?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a tremendous difference in the law as to how the court analyzes juror misconduct, as in Kelly, where the juror reaches out to her pastor, gets a pamphlet, brings it into the jury room, and that was found during the course of the trial. The trial judge removed juror O, who had gotten the pamphlet, voir dired every juror to ask what effect that had and if they could put that out of their mind and then deliberate. So that happened during the middle of the trial, but it was juror misconduct. All the other cases that he cited and the state relies upon are juror misconduct cases. Not unauthorized third-party communication that goes to the heart of the Sixth Amendment, right by a defendant to confront his accuser, to cross-examine witnesses who present evidence. And when a third party makes an improper contact with the deliberating jury before they deliberate, that falls at the heart of the Sixth Amendment, which is a different animal altogether than where a juror engages in misconduct. And that's where you get to Cameron. That's where you get to Green, which Green says it was a procedural communication, not a merits communication. And Your Honor, in Bryant, well, I would note Your Honor dissented in Kelly, but in Bryant, I mean, no jurors were interviewed, as best we could tell by the record. But in Bryant, it was a death penalty case. Law enforcement, I believe it was Horry County, were out questioning the jurors' relatives and friends and trying to get their belief as to whether they believe in the death penalty. Apparently, some of that kind of leaked back to one juror or maybe, but there was no record saying the jurors were prejudiced by that. But the court said that behavior cannot stand. And we find prejudice based on the conduct, not on the juror's testimony. And they didn't use the word presumption, but they found prejudice. And I don't want to get caught up in this issue of do we have to establish prejudice? I think prejudice is established, but the question has to be established, but the question is it presumed under the circumstances? And if it's presumed under the circumstances, what does the state have to rebut it? And so, you know, prejudice is the touchstone, but the question is evidentiary presumption. Here, where there's a third-party communication that goes to the merits of the case, the law is crystal clear that there is a presumption of prejudice, and the state has the burden of proving as harmless beyond a doubt.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Waters? You know, I'm not going to go back and forth a million times, but if you want to have a short comment, an additional part.
Very short, Your Honor. He said that these were not external influence cases, and every one of them that I listed was, Your Honor. Blake was a bailiff. Kelly was a pamphlet. Again, it was an external piece of information coming in. Grovenstein, it was an alternate. Again, that's an external influence. Bryant was a police investigation. Pittman was a bartender and a wife's comment. Green was a bailiff. And Covington was, evidence that was not admitted at trial that the jurors were aware of. So clearly all of those were external influence cases, Your Honor.
All right. I do not regard State versus Cameron as the guidance that needs to be used by me in making a determination about this case. It's a court of appeals case. Since that case in 1993, there have been several cases, including Green, Oliver, and others, that very specifically talk about this issue of what the burden is. won a motion for a new trial on the basis of after-discovered evidence that involves tampering or alleged tampering with the jury. All those cases say that prejudice must be proved, not presumed. And it may very well be that that is what's going to be shown. But for purposes of what the defendant must show as the case goes forward to an evidentiary hearing, the presumption simply by the contact, which we don't have any sworn evidence about except in the area of one juror at this time, a presumption is not the way to examine this issue, but rather specific evidence about what was said, when it was said, and how it was perceived by the juror is what I believe is required by State versus Green and other cases. And therefore, that is the approach I will take. All right, the next area of inquiry is the procedural argument of the state that this matter was untimely made. Mr. Waters?
Yes, ma'am, Your Honor. And again, we have raised the issue, as I talked about earlier, that we believe that there is at least an inquiry as to a procedural bar, that if the defense was aware of these allegations during the 10 days, then it is not after discovered evidence and the motion is untimely. And additionally, we also, as I previously expressed, have raised the issue that the affidavits on their face are insufficient to put in play an evidentiary hearing. And there are multiple cases that have in the state that have held, I think Yarborough is one of those that have held that where those that showing was not made, that the trial court properly denied an evidentiary hearing. So we would just preserve those issues, understanding the court's plan or procedure that you previously expressed.
All right. Mr. Griffin or Mr. Harpootlian, let me say that I will say to the defense, I mean to the state, I believe that issue needs further exploration, so I am not prepared to rule that this matter is untimely in the least. We're going to have a hearing on this matter, at which time this issue will be further explored. So the state has preserved its position, but you need not argue about that matter at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And now the matter that to me is the heart and soul of what we're doing today is the witnesses, the exhibits, and the procedure needed with respect to the witnesses. And the witnesses, at least, are the jurors and the clerk of court, Ms. Hill. What I'd like each side to explore with me is how those witnesses should be presented, who should present them, and how they should be questioned, and whether there are any brackets or limitations that should be imposed on what these witnesses are asked. And I will begin with the jurors, which is really the heart and soul of the matter. Other witnesses are very secondary to the first issue, which is the jurors themselves. Mr. Harpootlian, you are the moving party, and you may proceed.
Your Honor, we agree all 12 jurors should testify. I think both sides agree, Your Honor, to question those jurors. The only question is, not only question, but the first question would be, as Your Honor questions these jurors, would you, in all the cases the judge questions the jurors, would you want suggestions from us? As to what additional questions we, after they respond to your questions, that raise additional questions, that's number one. Number two, each one of these jurors, except of the original 12, I think all have been interviewed, maybe two have not been interviewed by Sled and given statements, recorded statements. The rest have all given recorded statements. And then Sled prepared a memorandum of interview. We have reviewed all these videos and the MOIs, and I can tell the court that the MOIs aren't consistent in many instances with what was said on the video, to the extent that information was left out. Now, if Your Honor is going to be very restrictive and ask, did the court communicate something to you, and did it affect your decision? I guess that's what we're hearing, Your Honor, when you're following State versus Green. If you're going to say that, ask those questions. I mean, there's some of these jurors who indicated they heard the court say what the juror that gave the affidavit for us say, and I think they're going to say it didn't affect them, which is fine. If it affected that one juror, we believe that's enough. That juror has obviously given an affidavit to us. The alternate, which was excused, and we keep calling her the egg lady, but she was also excused, the alternate, because she wasn't needed, the egg lady, because the judge found that she had had contact with people and discussed the case. They further indicated that the court said what we say she said, and we believe they should be examined. We'll be happy to do that, or the court can do that. So there are witnesses, and then we have the court herself. I talked to her lawyer this morning, who indicated she has not made a decision as to whether or not she would assert any constitutional right not to testify, and obviously that would be on a question-by-question basis. Maybe, I don't know, I mean, we're not ready to argue what the standard is on the Fifth Amendment this morning. But if she does testify, there are literally thousands of emails were furnished last week by Colleton County, some information furnished by SLED this morning and the Attorney General, which might be utilized, I can't say right now what it would or wouldn't, depending on her answer, to impeach, to contradict. So I can't tell you what exhibits there would be or what we would do because I don't know what her answers are going to be. We believe we should be able to examine her as a hostile witness. We should be able to call her as a witness because the burden is on us, as Your Honor just enunciated. Now, the only other thing I would say is this. Even if Your Honor determines that a piece of evidence or a question is not admissible for your consideration, for purposes of the appellate record, we believe we ought to be able to make a proffer. So it may be that Your Honor allows us to go forward, and then in your decision decide it's not relevant, in your decision decide you didn't consider it, or whatever. But a stop and go is going to elongate that hearing dramatically. And again, since you're the finder of fact, you can decide not what a jury's going to hear, but what you it matters to you. So we think that the examination of the court should be wide open, and we think that the exhibits we would use to impeach her, we would attempt to keep it relevant to the specific issues in this case. I mean, her son has been indicted, for instance, her son's been indicted for wiretapping. There seems to be some inference, at least what we read in the papers, we don't have any specific knowledge, that she was aware of that and that wiretapping was in relation to some ethics complaint about her. That's not relevant. We're not going to ask her about it. We're continuing to examine whether or not there is some connection there, and we're investigating that. But at this point, I would tell you, that's not where we're going. Where we are going, by way of example, is we have been furnished an email that she got on February 24th from somebody, which was a photo, a screenshot of looks like a posting on some sort of Facebook page, where the ex-husband of a juror, not the egg lady, alleges that his ex-wife has been talking about the case, and she is going to vote guilty because she hates men. Now, we know she got it. We know she got it on February 24th, yet on the morning of February 27th, she tells in the chambers, the hearing we were all present at, that she had seen a Facebook page posting by Eggway's ex-husband alleging that she was talking about the case and she didn't think he was guilty. That Facebook page had never been produced, and then she produced a Facebook posting, she said, by the Eggway's husband. Turns out to be a guy I interviewed in Georgia apologizing for what he had posted on Friday night, which concerned his wife's aunt meddling in their marriage. I think that's fertile ground for cross-examination. Your Honor may disagree with me, but I still would like to put those items into evidence for the appellate record at the time. The last thing I would say is this. In terms of Your Honor questioning the jurors, we need instructions from you as to whether you want, if you finish with the juror, do you want us to submit questions to you? Do you want, I doubt you're going to let us question them. How is that process going to work? And will that be done someplace? Will it be done in this courtroom? Will it be done somewhere else? And if the jurors are going to be questioned outside of this courtroom, will there be a way for the public to hear what they have to say? Thank you for your indulgence. Not just what they heard, may have heard from the court, but did any of the other jurors, for instance, Eggway, you keep calling her, gave an affidavit indicating Becky said things like, don't be fooled, watch the body language, watch body language testifies to Mr. Murdaugh. Did she relay that to any other jurors? It's not just what, I mean, was it, did it, or did the sitting juror, or the alternate, in the memorandum of interview, now, Kirk's private lawyer, Mr. Lewis, objected to any videotaping or audio taping of the court when she was interviewed. But in the memorandum of interview, the court indicated she had conversations with the four-way outside the presence of the rest of the jury about what was going on in the jury room. Obviously, I would cross-examine her on that, but it may be necessary to, if she testifies to things that are inconsistent in that MOI, for us to call the sweat agent that did the interview to corroborate the MOI. The MOI may be introducible in and of itself as an exception to the hearsay rule, but I believe it may be necessary for us to call the sweat agent. We're not going, and Your Honor, we're not. You've indicated that you're not going to want to know any sort of summaries of those interviews by the jurors when we talk back in chambers, or necessarily the MOIs. You want your own fact-finding with the jurors. To the extent that they contradict those, we may put all of that into the record for appellate purposes. And if you want to see those before you have this hearing, we could put those in the record today or have those available to you, both the MOIs and the videos. Obviously, we're going to do whatever you tell us to do, but we're looking for some guidance as to if there's anything we can get you prior to that evidentiary hearing concerning those memorandums interviewed by the SWED agents and the videotapes. Whatever you instruct us to do. Thank you for your indulgence, Bill. Thank you. Mentioned and Mr. Griffin reiterated to me just now, and obviously you don't need to tell us that this today because we're not going to be doing the questioning, but there is the consideration of 606B and the incursion into deliberations. At some point, we don't need to know that today, but at some point prior to you questioning the jurors, we'd like you to enunciate what your position is on that.
You're going to have to outline that a little bit more for me. What part of 606B are you discussing?
Well, it says, if I can find my glasses, upon an inquiry into the validity of a verdict or indictment, a juror may not testify as to any matter or statement occurring during the course of the jury's deliberations or to the effect of anything upon that or any other juror's mind as or emotions as influence a juror was sent to or dissent from the verdict.
All right, Sam, what are you saying that imports to this decision?
Well, I mean, for instance, if we show you, we prove to you that the court said, do not be fooled, or, you know, watch Murdaugh's testimony, watch the body language, inferring he was lying, he will be lying. One of the issues is if the juror who sat during the deliberations and said that the court said that, did she discuss that with any other jurors? Did she infect the jury? Does this allow you to do that?
Well, you certainly, if you go to 606B, it gives you some guidance about that. It says, upon inquiry into the validity of a verdict or indictment, a juror may not testify as to any matter or statement occurring during the course of the jury's deliberations or to the effect of anything upon that or any other juror's mind or emotions influencing the juror to assent or dissent from the verdict or indictment or concerning the juror's mental processes, except a juror may testify on the question whether extraneous, prejudicial information was improperly brought to the jury's attention, or whether any outside influence was improperly brought to bear upon any juror, nor may a juror's affidavit or evidence of any statement by the juror concerning a matter about which juror would be precluded from testifying be received for these purposes. I take that to give us the guidance we need about the parameters of the questions.
But if, again, if the juror that gave us the affidavit, would she be asked, did you discuss that during deliberations? Can she do that?
Apparently, is very questionable under the terms of 606.
Yes, ma'am.
And I intend to abide by that. The way those questions have been asked in many cases I have reviewed is to ask the juror whether that's still their verdict. If they ask about improper context and they talk about improper context, then the way to pursue it beyond that for the judge is to ask about the impact on the verdict, not on the deliberations themselves. But that may be a small slice of difference, but I think it's very important to understand that no one, not myself or anyone else, is going to be asking the juror about the specifics of their deliberation, and the rule is quite clear about that.
Okay. And is it clear that you will not be using the SWED interviews or MOIs to attempt to impeach
I told you when we brought, when that was brought to my attention in a chamber's conference this morning, I have made my mind up about that. I don't know what's in those summaries or anything else, and we're going to have to discuss that. But again, I'm the one who's questioning at this point, Mr. Harpootin.
Yes, yes.
And I'm trying to see what you all are asking, and I'm going to go to the state now and see what their reaction is to what you said.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Waters?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Your Honor, again, we would concur with what Your Honor just said about Rule 606 and, of course, all the cases that we've talked about and the need to show prejudice. And obviously, when you're talking about external influence, that prejudice, which will be an appropriate subject of inquiry to the jurors, is whether or not there was an impact on the verdict. And we, of course, have suggested to Your Honor, not only based on the cases, that should be judicially conducted in a manner that protects the privacy of those jurors and it protects the privacy of their identities. These jurors, were drafted into service, and this inquiry, of course, has to happen, but it needs to be conducted in a manner that respects their privacy and should be, of course, judicially conducted. We have suggested those two questions. If we look at the Bryant case specifically talked about the fact that depending on how the examination goes, there could be questions suggested by the parties. And obviously, I think we would need to cross that bridge if and when that bridge needs to be crossed. And that starts with the court's inquiry to those jurors. And only if something arises that needs further inquiry could that be addressed at that point. And that could be even a discussion from counsel with the court as to what additional questions may be proper. When the state first became aware of these allegations, the first thing that we did was have SLED do an independent investigation, and the goal was, good, bad, or ugly, to get to the bottom of what, if anything, happened. And the result of that is why we're still here today. And that is that in speaking with the jurors that spoke to us, that the balance of the evidence, as well as in talking to the clerk staff, was that there was no impact on any verdict. There was nothing unprofessional or untoward that happened that had any effect on the verdict. And so when we did that inquiry, and that is what the jurors said, that is why we're here today, and that's what this hearing is going to address. The only juror that we have is the one who filed the affidavit, that's 630, and even she, or that person, only said that she eventually voted guilty because she felt pressured by the other jurors, did not even mention any external impact. And so unless she's going to change her story, that is what was in her affidavit. So the balance of the evidence is the reason why we're here today and why this hearing needs to take place. Your Honor, as far as inquiry to those jurors, again, there could be a need that the parties would suggest questions, and it could be, depending on how things go, that the affidavits or maybe even the recordings, all of which have been provided to the defense, the full recordings of those interviews of any potential witness in this case have been provided to the defense. It could be that issues could arise from either the state or the defense as to impeachment. And we can address those issues as they arise under the appropriate rules, 608, 613, and the like, dealing with not only prior inconsistent statements, but other evidence that would be properly impeachable. Ultimately, I do need to address one thing as it deals with all of this, and that is the defense's contention that somehow the clerk is a party opponent in this particular case, and we believe that that is incorrect. Obviously, there is a hearsay exception or a non-hearsay determination in the evidentiary rules, I believe in 801, that excludes statements of a party opponent. But just because the clerk is an elected official and of the state, that does not make them a party opponent in the way that term is defined. A party opponent is an active litigant before the case. And that is, I think, different. So we would certainly say that the hearsay rules would still be in effect as it relates to Ms. Hill and any testimony that she may provide. I know there's been some discussion about the order in which the witnesses may be called and whether or not Ms. Hill would be a hostile witness. And obviously that's under Rule 611 and I believe C, which would allow leading questions, if a person is hostile. I think, again, at this point, I don't know that any showing necessarily has been made, but I understand the defense may raise that point, and we may have some arguments at that time. But I don't know that there's been such an identification between Ms. Hill and the state that would allow, A, her to be identified as a party. I think that's far out of bounds, but also that she would be applicable to allow defense leading questions under 611C. Your Honor, in looking at the type of examination that would need to happen here, and again, the issue also was arose of the Fifth Amendment. And I know that the defense would like to brief that issue, and we're happy to respond. We don't know exactly how that might arise in the course of any examination. We need to cross that bridge again when we get there. We would say, though, that the Fifth Amendment is question specific, and so again, it may be something that this court has to rule, as is in any sort of evidentiary presentation, question by question, based on any objection by the party. So it's kind of hard to say exactly what the blanket position would be until we actually get to that determination. Ultimately, the defense referred to some information provided this morning. Actually, both sides exchanged last night their communications with the clerk during the course of the trial. So both sides did that last night. And there were a lot of communications with the defense as well. I just want to point that out that there's any sort of allegation or insinuation that the state's not providing information. We've been very diligent about providing any and all information to the defense. And if any additional information arises, we will continue to do so. But both sides exchanged that last night. And of course, there's been some reference in their filings as to emails that were forwarded from the clerk to me and to my paralegal, and they've actually even listed me on the witness list. And Your Honor, as we have had a chance to peruse the defense communications with the clerk, there was just as much communication and offers of help. It was just a uniform across the board courteousness that's reflected from those. So we think that that's a non-issue, and we think that should not be something that arises during the course of this evidentiary hearing, at least as it would require communication from or testimony from attorneys. Your Honor, ultimately, as we look at the inquiry that will need to be conducted, as the state has made clear, it starts with the jurors. And only if something arises in that inquiry, further inquiry to those jurors may be necessary. And that could be in discussion with the parties, as I've stated before. And then I know Your Honor has indicated the clerk should testify, and we certainly understand that. The clerk filed an affidavit denying any of these allegations. And so, again, as we address the clerk's testimony, the state would have objection to some of the information I believe the defense would propose to examine her on. We believe that an inquiry should be limited to what is appropriate and relevant impeachment, but not should be just a far-ranging fishing expedition or full inquiry into a lot of subjects that have come up since the trial that we believe are not relevant to any inquiry that is before the court here now. Obviously, rules 404, 401, 402, and 403, as well as, which of course address relevance and 403 objections, 404, which addresses other crimes or wrongs or acts, rule 606, 608, which addresses inquiry into other specific acts and impeachment, and rule 613, which talks about prior inconsistent statements. All of those rules potentially could come into play depending on the nature of the testimony and the nature of the inquiry. But there have been allegations since the trial about the book, about this wiretapping case, about investigations into alleged use of office for improper gain. But again, all those are subsequent to the trial. And so again, depending on how the testimony goes, the state would raise appropriate objections at that time to limit the inquiry to what is appropriate for what is before the court, we would submit, and that is what occurred during the trial. So we would make those particular evidentiary objections as things developed. Ultimately, that would be the state's position. I know that we're trying to put as much meat on the bones as we can at this particular point in time, but I think the reality is that the court's inquiry to the jurors will really determine the nature of the inquiry that needs to proceed from there. And at that point, the state would take the positions that I've outlined here today.
You reply.
Please, Court, Your Honor. I find it somewhat ironic. The state is quoting Rule 404, Your Honor. One of the exceptions to 404, I know this would be surprising to Mr. Waters, is motive, as if he'd never heard that before. He told me this morning one of the assistants that worked for Ms. Hill during this trial was told by Ms. Hill during the trial that a guilty verdict would be good for sales of the book. Motive, selling books. So we believe we should be able to get into that. We should be able to ask Ms. Hill about it, and if she denies it, to call that witness, that assistant, and have her testify that she was told that. I mean, why would a clerk do what we allege she did? We think is important for your honor in terms of credibility and context. That's number one. Number two, your honor, I think we've all agreed, you're going to ask the questions, whether we agree or not. And we do agree with that. The question's going to become, as we go through that process, how, if a juror says X and they said in their interview Y, or if they said to us Y, or didn't include it in their original affidavit, and you don't ask that question initially, how are you going to handle, or do you care how we suggest to you a further question? Because as your honor's seen this morning, the back and forth can go on for a while, and we certainly don't want that to go on with a juror. So we're going to need some guidance on that. You know, I'm not expecting that guidance this morning. The last thing is, as these jurors are examined, I need to understand a little bit about the logistics. Are we going to do it in this courtroom? Are we going to do it in another courtroom? Is the public going to be able to hear the responses? Will there be an audio feed if we do it somewhere else? Are you going to have cameras turned? Are you doing it in this courtroom? Have cameras turned off? And we're obviously not going to refer to jurors by their names, even though three of these jurors went on the Today Show, another one went on ABC. They were all in the courtroom when the judge had them brought in. They were in the courtroom, all except one of them, for the verdict. Cameras were there then. I'm sensitive to their anonymity, but I don't know that any of them have any real anonymity anymore. Saying that, I think it's important not only for your honor to hear their answers, but for the public to hear their answers. Thanks. Thank you.
Respect to the jurors first as witnesses, I will be doing the questioning of the jurors, and I will notify the parties pretty promptly what I intend to ask the jurors. The ambit of what I will be asking them is informed by the question of whether improper contact was made with them and whether it affected their verdict. I understand that you, on the defense side, have views about what further should be asked the jurors on two levels. One, as a predicate to what you want to do with the clerk herself in examining her, and two, as a means of further attacking the credibility of the clerk in her testimony. I have not seen any of the SLED material or memoranda concerning the state summary of these interviews and so forth. I will be open to receiving that if it's done promptly, because we've got a hearing coming up the 29th, and I want there to be plenty of time to revise any current ideas about who to subpoena, who to call as witnesses, and who has to do that. But I can tell you that I am very, very reluctant to turn this hearing about juror contact into a wholesale exploration of every piece of conduct by the clerk alleged to have been improper on its own, indicative of her or characteristics or personality or anything of that nature. This is a very focused inquiry that deals with this jury and what impact contact, if any, had on this jury. So I am very mindful of the limited nature of it. As I say, I'm not excluding submission in advance of information that would take the questions beyond the limited questions I've initially indicated. But I will be very hesitant about any of those questions as it involves propounding those questions to the jury. As it involves questions to Ms. Hill, similarly, this is not a time to explore every mistake or incorrect statement or false statement that ever has been made by this witness. I am the judge of the credibility of this witness for purposes of this new trial motion. I don't think it's necessary, nor do I think it's proper, to explore each and every impropriety alleged to have been committed by the clerk. At the same time, what specifically should be asked is something that I will look at as I look at the submissions that are made before the before the hearing takes place about what is requested to be allowed as topics for questioning of the clerk and what exhibits should be used. I can't imagine allowing thousands of emails to be made exhibits in this process, either emails sent by her to attorneys in the case, to other court officials in the case, or to other individuals during the course of the trial of the case. I certainly will try to preserve the appellate posture of defense in this regard, but I will put certain limitations on just a wholesale exploration of every problematic piece of conduct, ethical, dealings with the county, and so forth. This is a very focused inquiry about this jury and its ability to render the verdict it rendered in an impartial manner. So I say that to tell you that when the clerk is offered, and I think the clerk is going to have to be offered as a witness, the whole allocation revolves around the contention that the clerk made contact with the jury about matters material to their verdict, that that contact was improper, and that it impacted their verdict. There's a whole lot more that Mr. Harpootling has indicated he'd like to explore that I regard as totally extraneous to the inquiry that we maintain. I'm not going to allow those questions to be asked by way of proffer and then have the clerk answer those questions and have that be the proffer, although I consider them irrelevant questions. We're not going to handle the case in that way. If I exclude a certain question from being asked, then the proffer will be whatever in writing is chosen to be offered in that regard. But I will not conduct a hearing where there's a whole side hearing in which every question desired is asked and either required to be answered or dealt with in some other way. I don't think that is an appropriate use of this very targeted hearing that I'm directed to have. also think it makes a great deal of difference whether the questions that are being asked relate to the clerk's conduct at the time this case was tried, as opposed to other conduct at a later time or in connections with other things than the trial of this case. So I will be looking very carefully before we conduct this hearing, trying to give the parties as much advice as I can about what I would find to be acceptable topics to pursue. I think you're entitled to that. But I also think the record of the case is not to be used as a platform to explore each and every fault of each and every witness, whether it be the juror or the clerk. And I'm not going to have the hearing conducted in that manner. I think there are other ways of preserving topics that I rule should not be pursued than having those questions asked and answered, even though I rule that they're not proper in the hearing. So I hope that explains kind of where I am on the subject of how questions are asked. And therefore, some of the suggestions that are made in the filings you've made with me about the additional witnesses you'd like to call and subpoenas, I think we need to be sure we're all on the same page about what is acceptable in evidence and what is not. But I can tell you that I would not allow the subpoenaing and examination of attorneys in this case, of the judge who heard the case, or any of those type of witnesses. This case is very focused on the jurors and the clerk of court, as I see it. Now, it's about 11:15, not close to it. I'm going to do this. I'm going to take a break for a minute. Let's take until 11:25 as a break. And in that time, I would hope that you formulate the other things you think we need to look at by way of the specifics of how this matter is to be conducted. I will then do two things. When I come back and ask you for further ideas, both sides, as to who should be called, get very specific about who can be called and who cannot, who should offer these witnesses. And I would also at that time ask those who represent potential witnesses in this matter to come forward and have a conversation with me about your position on behalf of your clients. I think that's particularly important because as we have the actual hearing itself, I've never heard of a situation where a witness can have their lawyer actively participate in the examination of the witness in a proceeding in which the witness is being offered. So I would not allow that, but I think we can protect the legal positions that attorneys for witnesses want to take and need to take and want to put upon the record by pursuing in the way I've just outlined, and I'll be prepared to do that when we return. All right, court will be in recess.
That wraps up segment one of the Alec Murdaugh status hearing in regards to his possible upcoming trial, which will be decided in an evidentiary hearing later in the month. There's a second part to this. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. It's coming up next. Stay with us.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Sick of the ads?
We opt to.
Start listening with no commercials now and get access to all of our episodes in advance of everyone else.
Become a True Crime Today Premium Plus subscriber on Apple Podcasts.
Search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts or go to our podcast page and sign up now.
True Crime Today Premium Plus.
Sign up now.
The
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.